Rex Edwin Lee graduated with high honors from Brigham Young University in 1960. He was student body president, valedictorian of his class, speech contest winner, and president of both the freshman class and the student senate. At the University of Chicago Law School, where he emerged as the top student in his graduating class, he was awarded the Doctor of Law degree in 1963. He had served as editor of the Law Review as a student. In 1963-64, he was a law clerk to Mr. Justice Byron White of the United States Supreme Court. Dean Lee's involvement with legal education began with the University of Arizona Law School, where he lectured on antitrust law. He has also taught international commercial law at the Thunderbird Graduate School of International Management and constitutional law, contracts, and conflicts of law for the Arizona Bar Review course. Dean Lee filled a mission for the church in Mexico, and since that time he has served as a worker in the Mesa Temple and as YMMIA stake superintendent. Presently, he is serving on the High Council of the BYU First Stake. He and his wife, Janet, are the parents of five children. Rex Lee was the founding dean of the J. Reuben Clark Law School, which commenced just last fall. He has done an extraordinary job of developing a curriculum, assembling a faculty, acquiring an extensive library, attracting able students, and launching the construction of a facility. The American Bar Association's recent approval of the law school is a credit to Dean Lee and to his remarkable faculty. It will be our pleasure to hear now from our forum speaker, Dean Rex E. Lee, who will speak to us on power, separation, use, respect, and restraint. Dean Lee.
I am honored to be occupying this position on this occasion. I'm pleased that my parents are in the audience, because I know that there are at least two people who will believe those nice things that President Oaks said. And second, I'm delighted that the time has come that a lawyer would be permitted to appear in public at the Brigham Young University. If you'd like some delightful entertainment on some occasion, just thumb through the index, the Journal of Discourses, and look under lawyers. Here's what you'll find. Contention increased by, deceitfulness of, dishonest methods among, education needed by in order to distort the truth. And here's my favorite. Honest man refuses pay for advice. The name of this institution is the Brigham Young University. Herewith the comments of Brigham Young about lawyers. When a lawyer comes into the church, if he happens to have a little common sense left, and will take to plowing and cultivating the soil, there is a chance for him to make a man of himself. But if he follows his former customs and habits, the chances are against him. He may ruin himself, lose the spirit of the Lord if he ever possessed it, and go back into midnight darkness. Well, we haven't exactly added courses entitled plowing and cultivating the soil to our law school curriculum, but we do take seriously the words of our leaders. Actually, I have two alternative explanations for the difference in attitude that exists toward lawyers then and now, and I am equally willing to accept either of these explanations. The first is that the lawyers of this generation are of a higher and more deserving sort than they've ever been at any time in the past. And the second is that we're just now becoming recognized for the fine fellows that we've been all along. As I say, I'm equally willing to accept either of those alternatives. One of the unique advantages of study at this institution is the opportunity to examine some of the relationships between the restored gospel of Jesus Christ and the great problems of people and their governments. I plan to examine such a relationship today. The subject is power, governmental power, institutional power, individual power. My principal thesis is that the highest manifestation of respect for power is the ability and the willingness, on appropriate occasion, to refrain from using it. It is my belief that this thesis is not only aptly illustrated by our three-part separation of powers that is the foundation of our constitutional system, but indeed that it is the very cement that has prevented the disintegration of the system itself. I plan to develop the thesis principally in the context of a discussion of the roles played by the courts in our country. I strongly suspect that when the history of the second half of the 20th century is written, it will record that among the dozen or so most significant events occurring during that period were these two. Number one, the ascendancy of the social, economic, and political significance of racial and other minority groups within our country. And second, the shift in political power, at least at the state legislature level, from the rural areas to the cities. There is, in my opinion, an interesting common denominator binding these two developments, in that each of them can be traced to decisions made by a court, the United States Supreme Court. Some of my friends in other disciplines, and indeed some of my friends in the law school, may disagree concerning the degree of the impact of court decisions on the increase in the influence of minorities. But I suspect there would be little disagreement that the decision in Brown versus Board of Education was an important contributing factor. And as to the second development, I am confident that absent the legislative apportionment decisions, it would have been many decades before the rural legislators in rurally controlled legislatures would have voted themselves out of office by reapportioning. These are probably the most dramatic, but they are not the only examples of the impact that court decisions, unadorned by anything else, have had on our lives. Who will be allowed to vote in school board elections? How much water can be stored behind Glen Canyon Dam? What controls can states exercise over pornography and abortion? Can states restrict welfare benefits to their own residents? My point is not concerned with whether these decisions were right or wrong, but rather the fact of their impact on our lives. Indeed, two of our more recent presidents, Kennedy and Nixon, have recognized that their appointments of members of the United States Supreme Court were among their most significant acts as presidents. President Nixon expressed the view as follows: "Our history tells us that our chief justices have probably had more profound and lasting influence on their times and on the direction of the nation than most presidents have had." The Supreme Court has not always occupied such a position of eminence. Our Constitution was adopted in 1789. The first justices of the court, interestingly enough, five in number, were appointed in September of that year. 5 months later, in February of 1790, the court met for the first time and dealt with such transcendental matters as the adoption of the seal of the court, rules governing the admission of lawyers to practice before the court, and the oath to be taken by those lawyers. And then, having no further business, the court adjourned. They met again in August of 1790, February of 1791. On both occasions, their activities consisted solely of formality, admitting some lawyers to practice. It was not until over 3 years after its initial members were appointed that the United States Supreme Court actually rendered a decision on the merits of a case before it. It's not surprising that activity of this level was not sufficient to maintain the interest of a man with the talents of the first Chief Justice, John Jay. Jay resigned his position on the court in 1795, and in 1801 replied to President John Adams' request that he take a second term of Chief Justice as follows: "I left the bench perfectly convinced that under a system so defective, it would not obtain the energy, weight, and dignity which are essential to its affording due support to the national government. nor acquire the public respect and confidence which, as the last resort of the justice of the nation, it should possess. What kind of metamorphosis of power has brought our federal judiciary from a system that John Jay accurately described as so defective that it could never acquire public confidence and respect, to an institution that has had such a profound effect on national policy that recent presidents have regarded the appointment of its members as among their most important functions as president? The answer, in my view, is bound up in the role that the judiciary plays as one of the three branches of our government, and even more importantly, its further role as a major beneficiary of the application of the thesis stated at the outset of this discussion. Every high school civic student knows about the separation of powers. The legislature enacts the laws, the judiciary interprets them, and the executive enforces the laws. And everyone lives happily ever after within this governmental Camelot, with all governmental responsibility being neatly identified and compartmentalized. In actual practice, the governmental functions are not always divided by such fine, bright lines. A cogent illustration is provided by the initial efforts of the Senate Judiciary Committee to gain access to tapes of presidential conversations having a possible bearing on that complex, discouraging, and mystifying series of events that we have chosen to lump together under the heading Watergate. The position taken by Senator Irvin's committee was forthright and easily understandable. The position was essentially this: we are conducting an investigation into alleged improprieties occurring during the presidential election of 1972, possibly involving misconduct by the president himself. We have not only the authority, but indeed the obligation to conduct such an investigation pursuant to our responsibility to determine whether election reform laws need to be enacted. These tapes constitute highly relevant evidence, and in order to discharge the responsibility that we have under the Constitution to enact laws, we must examine those tapes. President Nixon's position was equally clear and equally ascribed by him to his own constitutional responsibilities. The Constitution, he says, declares that the executive power is vested in the President of the United States. Implementation of my executive responsibility, both in the field of foreign affairs and also in the domestic sphere, requires that I carry on conversations of the most sensitive and confidential nature. It would be utterly devastating to my discharge of my responsibilities as president if persons with whom I converse knew that there was even the slightest possibility that the content of those conversations might be disclosed to anyone. Whether these particular tapes contain material of that nature is totally beside the point. The simple knowledge of the possibility that any presidential conversation might not be maintained in strictest confidence would work a complete change in the availability to the president of information and understandings that are indispensable to the executive function. And there you have it. Each side contending that his position is not only supported, but indeed required by the Constitution. What is the machinery for the resolution of disputes of this kind, since it involves a constitutional confrontation? We might expect to find the answers in the Constitution. Not only is the Constitution silent on the resolution of such disputes, it doesn't even expressly set forth the basic concept, separation of powers. The presidential tapes controversy is the most recent, and perhaps one of the most dramatic, but it is by no means the only instance in which this country has had to confront unresolved confrontations at the highest levels of government. Moreover, this ambiguity and functional overlap, which lies at the basis of the problem, you don't know what involves legislation or what involves the executive function or what happens when you have a conflict between the two is not limited to controversies between the executive and the Congress. In the latter part of 1951, a labor dispute arose between the nation's steel companies and their employees. Extensive efforts by the parties involved and the federal government over a period of months failed to resolve the dispute, and on April 4, 1952, the union gave notice of a nationwide strike to begin at 12:01 April 9. Because of the indispensability of a continuing supply of steel to the Korean War effort, and parenthetically because of President Truman's dislike of the Taft-Hartley Act, which offered the only reasonable alternative, President Truman on April 8 issued Executive Order 10-340 directing the Secretary of Commerce to take possession of the steel mills and keep them running. And the Secretary, incidentally, who was a little short on experience in the matter of stoking blast furnaces, in turn called upon the presidents of the various companies that owned the steel mills to serve as operating managers for the United States. It was President Truman's position that under the total circumstances as they existed at that time, the power to seize the steel mills and keep them running in order to provide the necessary war material was implicit in his constitutional powers as the nation's chief executive and commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States. The steel companies, on the other hand, whose officials had never really viewed themselves as federal employees, brought suit to enjoin the president's action. The United States Supreme Court, in an opinion handed down June 2, 1952, in the Youngstown Sheet and Tube case, held that the president had in effect made a judgment that was reserved for Congress and had therefore acted outside his constitutional authority. Well, there you have it. Court versus the president, president versus the Congress. Where do you go from there? What's the next step? In these kinds of contexts, you hear the words constitutional crisis. Those two words are used in such a variety of circumstances as to call into question the propriety of their invocation in any particular context. Any suggestion of overstatement in the present context, in my opinion, is quickly dissipated by considering some of the alternatives in the event that the controversy goes unresolved. Let's take the tapes hypothetical as an example. Assume that the case is pursued through the courts and that the Supreme Court ultimately holds that the president must deliver the tapes. What happens next? The president, through his lawyers, receives a copy of the opinion, assume that he reads it, and does nothing. The Supreme Court might then issue an order directly to the President to comply with its decision. The order is taken personally by the Marshal of the Supreme Court, all arrayed in the finery of his swallow-tailed coat, who delivers the order to the gates of the White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The Marshal is politely received and sent on his way. The next steps in the scenario have never occurred, fortunately, but we can speculate. The president has effectively thumbed his nose at the court, perhaps making a statement that he and his lawyers are just as capable of making of an interpretation of the Constitution as the Supreme Court. At this point, Senator Ervin might place a call to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and after mentioning in passing that the following week the military budget would be coming before the Senate Armed Services Committee, of which he is a member, assert that the president is acting unlawfully and that it is now the responsibility of the military to see to it that the court's order is enforced. No sooner is the conversation between Senator Ervin and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff terminated than the chairman receives another call. This time, from the President of the United States. The President's message is brief and to the point. Number one, I know what Senator Ervin has just asked you to do. Never mind how I know, it's because of certain electronic advantages that are available to me. Second, I am reading to you from Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution. The President shall be the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. Now, as your Commander-in-Chief, I command you to take no steps whatsoever with regard to this unconstitutional decision of the United States Supreme Court. Constitutional crisis? If anything, the term is too mild. Constitutionally explicit or constitutionally implicit, separation of powers lies at the bedrock of our constitutional system. Speaking of the Constitutional Convention, President J. Reuben Clark said that no greater concern was shown on any point than that there should be no encroachment by one department of government on any other. And yet, can you see what a fragile reed, in theory, this touchstone principle of our constitutional system really is? All that would be necessary to place the entire system in serious jeopardy would be for the protagonists on both sides of one of these controversies to dig in their heels and both refuse to move. There is simply nothing in our power structure, and arguably nothing in the Constitution, that requires either side to yield. And note that in our hypothetical, the effective decision-making authority in the country has effectively shifted to the military. We don't like to think of these kinds of things happening in this country, but ask yourselves how this kind of a confrontation would be resolved in Chile, or in Greece, or Santo Domingo. In many parts of the world, political power depends on physical power, and it is the military, not the electorate, that determines who will govern. Why not here? Given the theoretical fragility of the separation of powers concept, what are the practical supports that have prevented its collapse over the 200 years of our history? In my opinion, the principal support has been the role played by the judiciary against the background of a general observance in this country of the thesis announced at the outset that the highest manifestation of respect for power is the ability and the willingness on appropriate occasion to refrain from using it. You see, the underpinning of the basic problem is the absence of any constitutional prescription for the resolution of conflicts in governmental powers, particularly those at the highest levels. The greater interest of the public in a case like our Tapes hypothetical or the Steele seizures case is not whether President Truman is right, or the steel companies are right, or the court is right, but in the simple matter of having the issue resolved one way or the other, and in having all parties honor and respect the decision once it is made. There are three fundamental reasons that lead me to the conclusion that the resolution of such conflicts should be handled by the courts. The first of these reasons, and perhaps the most obvious, is that courts are operated by lawyers who are some of the finest fellows that you'll ever hope to meet. The second is the impracticability of the alternative. The alternative, I might hasten to add, has been advocated by no lesser figures than Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Abraham Lincoln. But with all due respect, it just won't work. The alternative is this, that each individual department of government makes its own decisions concerning constitutionality as required to do so by the responsibilities of its own office. To set the matter in perspective, we might analogize to a close call at an evenly contested basketball game. Was it an offensive foul or a defensive foul? Was it the go-ahead basket or was it offensive goaltending? Both teams are convinced that the decision should be made their way. The coaches and the fans on both sides are equally adamant that the cause of justice demands judgment in favor of their stalwarts. Picture what might happen, if you will, if there were no referee, or if the referee were the coach or the captain of one of the teams. Frankly, I've offered to perform the function many times from my vantage point right up there, and have in fact done so, but it hasn't worked. The confrontations among branches of government can be just as intense. The emotions on occasion run just as high, and of course the stakes involved are far greater than in the case of a basketball game. The temptation exists at this point simply to cast the courts in the role of referee and to observe that the reason for their importance is that they prevent crises which would otherwise result from insoluble confrontations at the top levels of government. But the analogy is not that complete. The black robes of the judge are not tantamount to the black and white stripes of the referee's shirt. The reason is that the court itself is one of the three coordinate branches of government. Once it renders its decision, the court becomes one of the branches whose conflicting powers are in dispute. In the steel seizure case, for example, Congress was never involved, and the conflicting powers were those of the president on the one hand and the court on the other, even though it was the court that had made the decision as to who was right and who was wrong in that particular controversy. And indeed, in any case, once the court has rendered its decision, limiting the powers of some other branch of government, the issue then necessarily involves the powers of the court itself. The third, and in my opinion the most important reason that courts are peculiarly well qualified to resolve constitutional disputes, including those disputes that involve their own powers, rests on the lack of any real enforcement authority in the judiciary. The Supreme Court has no army, and it has no purse. It has been labeled by Professor Bickel as the least dangerous branch for this reason. Because it is the only branch that has none of the incidents of physical power, it is the ideal repository for constitutional interpretation. I take great comfort in the fact that the responsibility for passing on the constitutionality of the activities of all branches of government is vested in the branch that has the fewest incidents of power in the traditional sense. Indeed, it has virtually none. And this means that the enforceability of its decisions must depend ultimately on the devotion of the American people and their leaders to the rule of law. All right, so we've seen how the courts go about their task. We have examined how the system works and not why it works. We have looked at the structure of the machine rather than how it is lubricated and what keeps it from flying to pieces. We have seen that the responsibility for resolving conflicts concerning overlaps in governmental power is properly vested in the judiciary. But why is it that these decisions, once made by the judiciary, are honored by the other affected branches? All it would take to place our constitutional system in serious jeopardy would be for the president, in a case like our hypothetical involving the tapes, or in the actual steel seizure case, simply to announce that he did not intend to follow the Supreme Court's decision. Indeed, something close to this, in fact, happened in the early 19th century in Worcester versus Georgia, when President Jackson uttered his famous dictum, "John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it." And it was never enforced. Fortunately for the country, it arose in the context of a case that didn't really raise the kinds of crisis that we've been talking about this morning, because it did not directly involve another of the three branches of government, and therefore the national government could continue to function in the face of the resulting impasse. In other contexts, our constitutional framework might not have survived such defiance of the courts by another of the coordinate branches. And remember that the courts have no enforcement power of their own. We all assume that President Nixon would obey a final order of the courts concerning the tapes. Why? This confrontation between President Truman and the steel mills was a very, very intense one. Indeed, a kind of a showdown kind of thing between over the Taft-Hartley Act. Why did he give up control of the steel mills? It was not because of the weaponry of the Supreme Court that was called into play. Why is it that our system is able to resolve these top-level disputes within the system rather than requiring destruction of the system? It is not because of any power structural safeguards expressly prescribed by the Constitution. Rather, it is, in my view, that in those ultimate confrontations when constitutional survival required it, leaders in this country have been willing to show their greatest strength, to exercise their greatest power by declining to use power. By the lawyers' measurement devices, President Truman lost the steel seizure case. And yet, in a much broader sense, the presidency itself, and derivatively President Truman, were the victors. By declining to exert one kind of power, he preserved the presidency itself and our constitutional system. Because of the necessary ambiguities in our Constitution, the separation of powers concept has built within it the seeds of its own destruction. The only reason that those seeds have never ripened into their all-consuming potential is that on each occasion, when it really mattered and when it really had to be done, someone high in our government was willing to exercise the most important of all of his powers, refraining from exercising power. And that, in my opinion, is what has bolstered the theoretical fragility of the American separation of powers concept. The highest manifestation of respect for power is the ability and the willingness on appropriate occasions to refrain from using it. On its face, the proposition is supremely paradoxical. On its face, it would seem a sure formula for assuring second-class status to any branch of government that subscribed to it. In fact, I submit that is not what has happened. In holding in Marbury versus Madison that it lacked the particular power at issue in that case, the power to issue original writs of mandamus, the court established for all time the greatest of all of its powers, judicial review. President Truman's decision to relinquish control of the steel mills following Youngstown Sheet and Tube actually strengthened the office of the presidency rather than weakening it. The most fascinating aspect of this analysis is its linkage to the principles and teachings of the restored gospel and the examples of church leaders. The 39th verse of the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants cautions that we have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. The clear message from this well-known passage is that this nature and disposition of almost all men, and certainly President Truman shared it, and certainly all presidents have shared it, is something that all men must strive to overcome. Look at the experience of the Savior. All three of the temptations presented by the adversary, turning stones into bread, calling forth angels to effect a miraculous rescue, and arrogating the adulation of the kingdoms of the world, involved the use of the Savior's power. Power which he could have called into play if he had chosen to do so. In each instance, it was the elder brother in this confrontation who exercised the greater power by refusing to exercise power. An equally cogent example is provided by the Savior at the close of his ministry. Of the billions of persons who have inhabited this planet, Jesus Christ was the only one who had power over his own life and death. He did not have to die. By his own will, he could have prevented his own death. By his own will, he could have spared himself that pain, grief, and suffering, which we not only cannot describe, but cannot even comprehend. That he did not do so provides the supreme example of the principle we are examining. The most complex, the most fascinating, and the most important power that mortal beings possess is the power to create human life. As President J. Reuben Clark has reminded us in his fascinating book, Man, God's Greatest Miracle, it is also the most difficult to understand. With all of man's scientific achievements, the one thing that man has never been able to do and never will be able to do, with all of his technology and intellect, is to bring life into being, even in its most elementary forms, or to restore life to any living thing once it has been permanently snuffed out. And yet, this greatest of all mortal powers lies within the human body. It is accompanied by an appetite. The popular voice in recent years has declared that the human organs of creation are principally instruments of pleasure, that we should recognize them as such, and that we will be a much happier people when we discard our traditional hang-ups about premarital and extramarital promiscuity. You and I know that this is false. The restored gospel teaches that neither the power nor its appetite is to be used indiscriminately. Both are to be confined to the marriage context. The prophet Alma declared that adultery and fornication are second in their gravity only to the shedding of innocent blood or denying the Holy Ghost. We find further examples in the lives of some of our leaders. I suspect that many of you have experienced, as I have, the inconvenience and even the irritation of waiting for a handball court or a basketball court. From time to time, I've played basketball with a group that has included my friend President Oakes. And incidentally, he's a fine president and a good friend, but he's no threat to Mark Handy. I recall the glee with which I looked forward to the first such occasion, contemplating that this time there would be no waiting for a court. And in candor, I must confess that my anticipation was probably based on more than just the inconvenience of having to wait to play. I suspect that deep within my soul, there were yearnings for superiority that I felt would be nourished by the specter of a grand entry onto the court, with the existing occupants quickly and deferentially vacating the premises before the majesty of our presence. You can imagine my chagrin when we stood and waited, just like I had always stood and waited, for our turn. I didn't get to play any sooner, but I learned a lesson. Following what proved to be his last appearance before the student body last fall, President Harold B. Lee visited informally with some of the university administrators in the afternoon. It's a priceless experience that I will always remember. For 45 minutes, he taught us by telling us stories. Parenthetically, an interesting common denominator of these stories was that in each case, the teaching point involved a mistake that President Lee had made in his own administrative experience. One of these stories bears directly on the present discussion. Prior to his appointment as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, President Lee had served as managing director of the Church Welfare Program. In that capacity, he had a disagreement, as even church administrators have, with the presiding bishop's office, which, as I recall the story, the presiding bishop's office resolved and implemented without consulting Brother Lee, and then refused to talk to him about it. 2 weeks later, he was appointed a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. And a short time after that, he was on a trip to Tooele with President Clark. And at what he considered a particularly propitious time, asked, "Do you suppose that maybe now the presiding bishop's office would be willing to talk to me?" President Clark's response was this: "Yes, my boy." Somehow I have a hard time picturing anyone referring to President Lee as boy, but apparently that was one of the pet phrases that President Clark used. "Yes, my boy, now you have the whip hand. There's a great temptation to use it, but you must never do so. Now you have the whip hand. There is a temptation to use it, but you must never do so." President Clark, President Lee, President Oaks, Prophet Alma, Savior of the world, all great men, all have had experience in the use of power and have used it for good. And all have demonstrated that the highest manifestation of respect for power is the ability and the willingness on appropriate occasion to refrain from using it.